This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 218. Today we speak with Mark Jones about diversity and debates within 17th century British Puritanism. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 218. My name is Camden Busey. I'm in studio today, but I've connected with my friends over Skype. We have a wonderful conversation lined up for you on a fascinating subject here. Let me introduce to you today our guests and our contributors. We have Nick Batzig, who is church planter just outside of Savannah, Georgia, in Richmond Hill, Georgia. With a church plant there, Covenant Church. Welcome back, Nick. It's great to have you.
Hey, Camden. Good to be on.
Yeah. How's the church planting going? I know you're always busy, and that's always a subject. We were talking about that a little beforehand, because both of you are into church planting and in that work. How are things going down in Georgia? Why don't you provide an update for our listeners?
Sure. Thanks. Yeah, it's good. The Lord seems to be establishing the church. We're just 3 years in. It feels like I'm in a MMA fight with Fedor every couple weeks, just getting knocked down with work, and church planning's not for the faint of heart, so no. But it's good. I know you don't like Fedor either.
I think he's overrated, but he's on the downward spiral of his career. Then anyway, that's another debate about the morality of combat sports, but we can talk about that some other day. We'll table that discussion. But it's great to hear from you, Nick, and it's good to have you on the program again, and we pray that your church will continue to grow. And we ask people that are in the area, if you're near Savannah and looking for a church, or even if you're just visiting, check out Nick's church. You can look him up. I'll put links in the show notes, and you can visit and participate. We're also very pleased to welcome back to the program our guest today, Reverend Dr. Mark Jones, who is the minister of Faith Presbyterian Church, a congregation of the PCA in Vancouver, British Columbia. Welcome back, Mark. It's great to have you on again.
Thank you for having me on, guys.
We had a great discussion last time we spoke with you on Jesus plus nothing equals everything, and we got into some of the historical discussion on the subject of antinomianism and et cetera. So, Mark, it's great to have you back, and we're excited to talk about a related topic here on the covenant of works and the covenant of grace, all sorts of things. We have in front of us an edited volume edited by Mark Jones and Michael Hagen, titled Drawn into Controversy, Reformed Theological Diversity and Debates Within 17th Century British Puritanism. So we'll get to that in just a minute. But do we have any points of news or any other updates we need to mention?
Well, I would just mention Mark's other book, Camden, that we talked about.
Yeah.
That's going to come out, I guess, this August. Is that right, Mark?
Yeah, August, we hope.
Book that Mark and Joel Beakey have published, have written together, Puritan Theology. I hear that it's going to be pretty much a standard for Puritan studies as far as the views of the divines and other British Puritans, English Puritans on just all the systematic topics. Is that right?
Yeah, there's about 59 chapters, so where we've tried to cover it's basically systematic theology with everything covered. There's obviously some things that aren't covered, but books wouldn't end if you covered everything.
and Mark will have a couple chapters in there that'll be sort of a expansion of some of the themes we'll talk about today out of these chapters.
It looks very book on. Yeah, definitely some overlap on some of those subjects: covenantal conditions, covenant of works, covenant of grace, all those sorts of things. Fascinating. Who's the publisher of that, Mark?
Reformation Heritage Books are putting it out.
That was my suspicion, and I'm excited to hear that. I didn't want to suggest it, and if it was the case that wasn't the publisher, to be embarrassed by that. But I figured RHB would be doing that title, and they're a wonderful publisher, and you can check them out online. All sorts of great topics and books come out from them, and they're very high quality volumes too, and they're printed in a wonderful way. So check them out, RHB, Reformation Heritage Books. I know there's a whole bunch of conferences and things going on. You can check our calendar for updates and information about where those are and the places that some of the Reformed Forum folk will be. We won't go through all those details, but you can visit us online at reformedforum.org for updates, as well as information about how to subscribe to our Google Calendar for constant information about our recordings and our conference attendance. But we should also mention, of course, that Christ the Center, our program today, is listener-supported, and we rely on the generous support of all of our listeners and donors to help us to produce and distribute all of these programs free of charge. We've been very blessed lately, and we're moving into new territory in terms of new opportunities and new technology and things we're trying to establish and get going. And so we need your help, and we thank everybody for supporting us so far. But we ask you to continue and help us to move into a new era of Reformed media. So I want to thank everybody for supporting us, and especially this program, Christ the Center. All right, guys. Well, this book, fantastic piece, and the subject matter is going to be very interesting for all of our listeners, no doubt. It's from, is this an academic publisher, Mark Vandenhoek and Ruprecht?
Yeah, they're a German publisher in Göttingen.
I should have said Vandenhoek.
Well, it's I never say that. I just anglicize it. But yeah, it's a German publisher. They do a remarkable job with the print out of the books, the paper, and all that. The only problem is they make sure you pay for it.
Well, those are the typical ways of the academic publishers. So. Yeah, you're going to get that. But Nick, you mentioned some of this is on Google Books. You can at least get a healthy dose of what the book is about. You can read several pages, can't you?
Yeah. I mean, that's something if our listeners want to check it out and see if it's a volume that they would want to buy, because like Mark said, obviously these works are fairly substantial in price. And
I should mention also, you can always go to your library, and even if you're not by a seminary or a theological library, there's such a thing called interlibrary loan, which is it's not a new idea, but it hardly ever gets used except by some obscure doctoral students. But you can often get these volumes. So if a seminary in Michigan, for instance, has a copy of this, and you live in Georgia or you live in Kentucky and don't have a seminary down the street or any university that has this book, you can still get through interlibrary loan. They'll ship it to you and you'll have it for a while. So if you can't cough up the money to buy it, even though it is definitely worth the money, you can definitely get it through your library system. So I'd encourage listeners to do that, not only for this volume, but for any volume that you need. It'll take some time, but you can get it. Mm. You ever do that, Nick?
I have done it in the past. It's been a while, but I think also Library Thing, is that what it's called? There's a couple websites where people catalog their libraries, individuals and schools, and you can find within whatever radius of where you live, mileage, how far. But you're right.
Yeah, WorldCat does that too.
I was looking for a scholarly volume by a woman on the Song of Solomon not long ago, and there were only about five or six schools in the U.S. that had it, and Georgia Southern was one. It was only an hour from where I live, so you never know, you know, who's going to have this out of, you know, just sort of random interest for these volumes. Mm-hmm. So
you took your scanner to the library and scanned the full book?
I did, man. I have spent many hours at a copy machine, let me tell you, getting rolls of dimes.
pushing the limits of, fair use, no doubt.
You get 100 pages. I think you get 100 pages for research on, I forget the... There's a limit.
Yeah, there definitely is a limit. We'll put it that way. Anyway, enough on the finer points of library science, but it is something that I get questions. We receive questions at Reform Forum sometimes about where people can find used books or cheaper copies of books. You can always go to bookfinder.com, but one way to get an academic title that's not in your area if you don't want to pay for it, is through your library. It doesn't matter what library, almost all of them are connected with each other. So check it out, Library Loan, Interlibrary Loan. Well, all right, Mark, why don't we get into this, and why don't you tell us a little about the story about the way this book came about. How did you get connected with Michael Haake, and what were the beginnings of this edited volume?
Well, I was doing a lot of reading for my thesis on Goodwin, and I noticed that when you read a lot of the Puritans and Continental Divines, you You'll see them saying our divines, and then they might set out different positions and opinions. And sometimes it was explicit, and sometimes I had to sort of fish around to see what was going on with the debate. But generally, there were a number of debates that kept coming up that were what I would call intra-reform debates. Mm-hmm. So not Arminian versus Reform, but within the Reform tradition, they right. disagreed on a number of issues. So I started noting these down and had in mind to do a book where I would look at all of the different debates within the Reformed tradition, and specifically Puritanism, because you could do a book like this on the Dutch tradition or the Reformation, and we're actually doing one right now in the 18th century. So wow. When I pitched this idea to Michael at a meeting for my thesis supervision, he was immediately excited, and we just got down to work. So it took a few years actually to get all of the various guys involved and the publisher happy with the manuscript. But yeah, there it is. That's how it happened.
Mm. You know, we've had Michael Haken on the program before, and anyone that's familiar with him and his work will definitely know he's certainly a qualified scholar, and so it's fantastic that you two have been able to connect people with expertise on this subject to bring this about. Why focus on these controversies? Isn't this just here's an easy question? Isn't this just stuff that happened a couple hundred years ago? I mean, is it really important?
Yeah, well, the thing that one of the other reasons that I was really keen on this topic had a little bit to do with what can sometimes happen in reform circles today, where there's a sort of idea that there is just one view on an issue. Mm-hmm. And on some issues, there is one view. You don't debate Christ's two natures.
Right.
But things aren't always so neat when it comes to other doctrines. And so one of my main hopes is that we'll be able to, in the Reformed tradition, affirm some diversity within reason, and not castigate or kick someone out of the pale of orthodoxy because they hold a view that isn't exactly the one that someone else may hold to. So that was the reason for that, and I hope that this book in some way goes to showing that there is allowed to be some diversity in our tradition.
Yeah, it's always a sensitive subject when we talk polemics, especially intra-reformed polemics, and there can be this tendency to develop a litmus test of sorts on all sorts of issues, whether or not those criteria that we set up for testing someone are within or without the circle. And so people can say, well, if you have a certain view of covenantal merit or a certain view of a law gospel distinction, then you can't be reformed. Well, that may or may not be the actual reality of things, but it's interesting to study in the history of reformed theology the different views that have come up and try to figure out according to the creeds and confessions and ultimately according to scripture which ones are correct and which ones are not, which ones are acceptable and which ones are unacceptable. So, Nick, what are your what's your take on this volume first? Where would you like to start with the discussion? Why was your eye so drawn to this volume?
Well, Mark and I have talked over the years about some of the things he's written on, and Mark has done a tremendous job of doing research in the Puritans, especially the members of the assembly with regard to covenant theology, covenant of works, Mosaic covenant, covenant of grace, how all that's connected, and I think Mark's chapter in this volume on the Old Covenant is a nice introduction to some of the diversity that he mentioned that existed with the divines. That's important because even in recent years with federal vision debate, that's been a big thing where whether there was such a thing as a covenant of works,
yeah.
How we view the Mosaic covenant, really not just federal vision, but, across the board, broad evangelicalism. Is the moral law still for us? What role does this play in sanctification? Really, almost every major issue that we're discussing online with regard to the law and the gospel and, sanctification really is interconnected in some way with the theology of covenant of works, covenant of grace, and so
historical Adam too. If there was no historical Adam, it calls into question any reality of or veracity of a covenantal arrangement.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, it's all interconnected. And I think Mark has done a really helpful job of showing you, even as the divines were, you know, systematizing some of their stuff on these issues, some of that diversity. Mark, I wanted to just ask you to open up the idea of covenant theology in the 17th century. I know that's a huge subject, but just if you could bring our listeners up to speed with maybe a little bit of the development of covenant theology in the 17th century, specifically with the idea of conditionality and maybe even some of the difference there. That's kind of where you start in your chapter on the Old Covenant. So,
okay, well, this book tries to show there's diversity within the Puritan tradition, and immediately that sets off a number of factors that have to be considered, because the Puritan tradition didn't arise in a vacuum. It grew out of the Reformation, and it's also a tradition that's in close continuity and close sort of engagement with the continental tradition. So you've got the inheritance of Calvin and Vermigli, and then later also you've got later after the Puritans, but sort of within that era of Vitsius. And so you've got all these different figures going on, and how does it relate to 16th century? So there's the Calvin versus the Calvinist thesis that comes up a little bit in this book. And one thing Richard Muller does is show that you can't really have Calvin against the Calvinists when some of the Calvinists are against each other on certain issues. It's a strange way to look at things. So within the Puritan context, of course, you have another context that's specifically related to their home fronts with the Antinomians, the Roman Catholics, the sort of the Church of England or Anglican theologians and Neonomians. So you've got all of these other traditions also hovering around, which means that they have to be very careful with the way in which they speak about the covenant and things like conditions. So covenant conditions were something they needed to affirm, and yet had to be very careful that they didn't affirm it in such a way that led them to Neonomianism or Roman Catholicism. So that maybe explains why you have some of these words being used like conditions that might make us a little bit uncomfortable, but nevertheless, they're definitely there. If you want me to move into conditions, I can, but if there's anything else, I'll happily answer that.
I would like for you to expound a little bit on the conditions of the covenant. I know in our own day, there's a lot of discussion about whether we're to view God's covenant of grace as conditional or unconditional for believers, for the elect. And so in your work and your study in the Puritans, what are some of the nuances that arise, and what do you find to be really helpful in them, and is there diversity among them?
Well, there's certainly diversity in the Puritan tradition, but of course the Puritan tradition is not synonymous with the Reformed tradition. So what I would say is that in the mainstream Puritan tradition among Reformed theologians or Calvinists, you would definitely find almost all of them affirming conditions, but you would find them affirming conditions in a way that protects the graciousness of the covenant of grace, for example. But it was without dispute, and I think Francis Roberts makes a comment that many and great absurdities or inconveniences and paradoxes inevitably follow if you deny a conditionality of the covenant. And so they were at times very strong, and you'll find that in a Baptist, Paedo-Baptist polemic between John Flavel and Philip Carey. Did Philip Carey actually denies covenant conditions in the way that Flavel affirms them? So it wasn't also a debate between the Antinomians and the Reformed, but also with Baptist theologians against Reformed theologians. So a lot was at stake. I can go into the sorts of types of conditions they had and how they fleshed them out, if you think that would be helpful.
Yeah, I'd like to hear that.
Yeah. That'd be great.
Well, there were definitely, in the broader covenant of grace, and if we want to talk about salvation in its broadest aspect from beginning to end, not salvation limited to justification, but salvation in the big picture, there was looked at the condition of necessity of faith, and then there was the necessity of evangelical obedience, and sometimes they made a further distinction between the necessity of good works for salvation. And the main sticking point initially was the necessity of faith for salvation. And the big difference between the Reformed and the Antinomians, for example, was whether faith was a condition. The Antinomians believed not in justification from eternity, as some have thought, but they believed in justification from birth, so that an elect person, from the time they're conceived, is not under God's wrath, so that when they come to existentially believe in Jesus for salvation, it's actually just affirming something that's already true of them. And so for them, conditions were rejected in that sense, whereas typical Reformed theologians, even theologians like Thomas Goodwin, who believed in justification from eternity, nevertheless held that a sinner was under God's wrath until they exercised faith in Jesus Christ. Now, where it gets very tricky is whether faith is an antecedent condition in order to receive the promises of the covenant, or a consequent condition. And by and large, they affirm that faith was an antecedent condition, and it had a sort of instrumental cause of receiving the benefits of the covenant, which included justification and sanctification. So faith is an antecedent condition, but then they distinguish between types of conditions, and they'll bring up Roman Catholic issues. So they want readers to be absolutely certain that they're not affirming it where faith has a sort of meritorious or impulsive cause, but rather it's an act of ours, even though it's not perfect. But yet it is still our act whereby the blessings are channeled to us through faith from the covenant, and it's a necessary act of ours. And then they also distinguish between the act and habit of faith, but the act of faith was crucial for receiving the benefits of the covenant.
Now, some of them are going to talk about legal conditionality too, right, over against Rome, where I know you'll find in the later Reformed scholastics, Turretin, for instance, saying that there's the legal conditions of the covenant, and then what you've mentioned, the evangelical conditions, the legal being perfect obedience to God's law in that sense, I'm losing my words today. The divine demand for perfect perpetual obedience would be the legal conditions of the covenant, and then faith and repentance,
yeah,
broadly considered, would be the evangelical. Is that correct?
Yeah, the evangelical conditions, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, where faith was the condition, the antecedent condition, and then there were consequent conditions that were evangelical, as well as the condition of faith, which was antecedent. And the consequent conditions were evangelical obedience and the necessity of good works. But they were consequent to being brought into the covenant. But to be brought into covenant with God required faith. Now, all affirm without question that faith is the gift of God, and yet it still must be an act of faith on the sinner's part in order to receive the blessings through union with Christ. So that's the basic position of the Puritans, and you don't find much disagreement on that point. Much of the disagreement has to do with the types of covenants and how they relate to one another, but generally it would be looked at as antinomian in order to deny conditionality.
Hmm.
Right, and I thought your section on that was very helpful. You then move in your chapter into a brief discussion on the covenant of works. I know you expand on that in an entire chapter in the book you have coming out with Beakey, but when you come to the covenant of works in the English Puritans, and even among the divines at Westminster, you are going to have diversity. And could you just explain to our listeners a little bit about that diversity, some of the maybe some of the disagreement and maybe some of the agreement on that, in so much as it's reflected in the confession and the catechisms?
Sure. Well, the confession gives you the sort of important bare bones of what must be affirmed in the covenants of works. But if you read various divines, they go into quite a bit of detail, trying to come to grips with how to speak about the covenant of works, what was involved, what wasn't involved. And it was really quite a fascinating topic of discussion. And in the book Drawn into Controversy, Mark Herzer, a PCA minister in Glenside, he does the question that initially occurred to me about Adam's reward, whether it was eternal life, heavenly life, or continued life in the garden. So there's an example of a debate where you have someone like Thomas Goodwin affirming very robustly that Adam's reward was continued life in the garden, and then you have someone like Turretin who argues the opposite, that Adam's reward was heavenly life. Which is interesting, because today in our context, you'll find people insisting that Adam's eschatological reward must be heaven, which is fine. It's perfectly reformed to do so, but it's also no less reformed to insist that his reward was continued blessedness in the garden. And that's tied up with crucial Christological debates. And I would even say the supralapsarian question enters into the discussion of Adam's reward. So once you get into any one of these debates, you could basically move into every other area of the book, which shows how interconnected these debates were.
Now, Mark, I wanted to ask just a modern sort of applicatory question here, because, you know, years ago with the Federal Vision debate, the big issue was the majority of Federal Vision men, if not all, I mean, I even think Doug Wilson would deny that there was ever such a thing as a covenant of works. So laying aside the diversity that you mentioned among the divines about what the reward would have been, was there anyone that you've read from the Westminster tradition who flat out denied any kind of covenant of works, who would have taken issue with that among the assemblymen?
One thing that Richard Muller taught me, that was we had a breakfast a little while ago, and he said, this is what he says to his students: never say never and never say everyone when doing historical theology. And he has a good point there, because if I say that everyone affirmed a covenant of works in the Puritan tradition who was reformed, which I believe I could say, there's always that chance that someone will comment after this interview or find someone who denied in some way the covenant of works. Now, some people didn't, which is interesting because of the relationship to John Murray in our own context. There was someone like Francis Roberts, who talks about the covenant of works and the covenant of faith, not the covenant of grace, because he wants to affirm that grace is present in both covenants. So there you have sort of a terminological issue. But I would say almost every Puritan that I'm aware of affirmed the covenant of works, and that's why you find it fully confessional. And no one really disputed that Adam's reward, whatever that would have been, was contingent upon his obedience. Now, there were questions of how he carried out his obedience and the Holy Spirit's role and grace and stuff like that, but it was certainly his obedience and not the obedience of anybody else on his behalf.
Right. And it's interesting that, you know, even in a guy like William Strong, I think you'll find the language that we find in the confession used in a variety of ways. Covenant of works and covenant of life are the two terms for the prelapsarian covenant between God and Adam and his posterity. And I had a professor who had shared with us what I think is likely what the divines were trying to intimate in their unified statement in the confession, that the phraseology covenant of life would speak more of the reward, even if there was diversity there, whether Adam would have stayed you know, would have been confirmed in holiness on earth, or whether he would have entered into this heavenly state. But that covenant of life referred to the reward, covenant of works referred to the conditionality, or to the nature of the covenant itself, what it demanded. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's a good point, because there were a number of different terms that were used. It's not like Calvin came up with the covenant of works. You see the concept present in him, but he never used the term, which doesn't mean that he wouldn't have agreed with the Westminster Divines. But you'll find that things take time to concepts, terms take time to evolve. And what you have, Willem van Asselt actually in his work on Coxeus, speaks about the fact that there was the covenant of nature, there's the natural covenant, there's the covenant of creation, covenant of law, you have friendship with God, and then you have covenant of works, and you even have Goodwin calling it the law of creation to describe the covenant of works. So there are a number of terms that emphasize different aspects of what was going on in Eden, and I think they're helpful to bring out the different sides of the context that Adam found himself in.
Now, I know there's a tremendous debate, and I think your chapter that's going to come out in Beakey's book especially is very helpful, and you're in Dr. Beakey's book on the Covenant of Works will be helpful to our listeners in just bringing them up to speed with the various men who have written on this subject, because there are so many Puritans that were at Westminster that that are not as popular as some of the other ones, but who wrote, you know, pretty substantial volumes on covenant theology. When we move into the covenant of grace, though, the difficulty seems to arise and the diversity seems to arise specifically with regard to the Mosaic covenant. I know you mentioned Calamy and Edward Calamy's discourse on the two covenants, and he sets out a few of the views, having been one of the committee members to study and listen to the different views on the relationship between all the covenants, covenantal administrations. But in the covenant of grace, for the sake of time, maybe we could just move into the Mosaic covenant, Mark. And if you could talk a little bit about the diversity of views there. And even you mentioned Owen a lot in this chapter, in this volume, Owen's specific view on the Mosaic covenant in relationship to the new covenant.
Sure. Yeah. Well, the debate is interesting, because you've definitely got a disagreement going on, and you'll have Owen who sets out the disagreement in terms of a sharp antithesis between old and new covenants. What's tricky, and I think sometimes people miss this in discussing the debate, is that on the one hand, you've got biblical covenants that are being used, like the Old and New Covenants are biblical covenants, they're historical covenants, and you'll find them explicit in Hebrews 8. But then you've got theologizing going on, or the idea of systematic theology, where the covenant of grace is not so much something you find explicit as you would find the Old Covenant in the Bible. So you've got a sort of theological construct being used together with an explicit biblical covenant. And it's always difficult then relating something that's a construct to something that's explicitly biblical. Now, of course, the covenant of grace is biblical. It's not that it isn't. But when you relate a theological covenant with a biblical covenant, there's always going to be difficulty in the way in which you use terms and how people understand them. So you can use the covenant of grace in such a way that it could easily embrace all of the post-lapsarian covenants, or you could use the covenant of grace in such a way which would restrict it to certain covenants. And so that's part of the difficulty I find, is that Owen doesn't make the covenant of grace synonymous with the new covenant, for example, which I bring out a little bit in the chapter, and certainly in the book with Joel, that he sees a distinction between those two covenants.
And even among members of the assembly, I know William Strong will say that the law promulgated from Sinai, not the Mosaic Covenant per se, but the law in its bare form, if it were extrapolated out, and he doesn't say that, but this is obviously what he is intimating, if the law were taken in its bare form with its demand for perfect obedience, its promise of blessing upon obedience, cursing upon disobedience, is the form of the covenant of works, is what he'll say. So Strong will not... he will not say that the Mosaic Covenant is a covenant of works, but that the law itself embedded in it is a manifestation of the form of the covenant of works because of the demand for perfect obedience. And then you mention a couple guys in this chapter who will actually and I guess Owen is the big one. I think also William Perkins, maybe in his commentary on Galatians, will say that the Mosaic Covenant was, he'll use the language covenant of works. And in that sense, you get into the whole republication debate. What is your understanding of the majority view, if we could put that, of the divines with regard to the relationship between the Adamic covenant and the Mosaic covenant? And is there a majority view?
Yeah, I would say there's definitely a majority view, and you'll find them described in my chapters, dichotomous. So they posit a distinction between the covenant of works and the covenant of grace, and within the covenant of grace would fall the old covenant and the new covenant, and Davidic and Noahic, and that's another debate as well, the role of the Noahic covenant, which for most was part of the covenant of grace. So Westminster Confession of Faith 7.6 seems to lean more in favor of a dichotomist position, but on many issues, I would say that it leaves room for people like Owen, no question. He's not ruled out by the confession at all, but I think most people would read that the covenant of grace was administered differently in different times, and that would include the old covenant. And so the republication of the covenant of works has to be understood very carefully, because there were distinctions between material republication, formal republication.
Right.
So you can look at it as a strict republication of the covenant of works, or you could look at it as just the form of it. And once those distinctions are made, some of the differences of opinion from different guys starts to evaporate a little, but I think it's still important to note that you'll find there is still nevertheless disagreement on this point. But I think the confession, while leaning in a dichotomist way, would definitely allow for Owen's view. And Owen's view, as I mentioned in my chapter, isn't really able to fall neatly under dichotomist or trichotomist positions. He's so nuanced and speaks so carefully that sometimes categories for him just don't work.
Right, right. Yeah, I think you're right. I think in my reading of the confession, it does seem pretty clear to me that they were dichotomists, that they saw two covenants, covenant of works, covenant of grace, and then everything post-lapsarian would fall under administrations. And then obviously the old and the new, they say one covenant different administered differently, which does obviously leave some wiggle room for diversity there. One thing that you mention in this book when you talk about conditionality, and I'm backing up to kind of tie this in now, because when we look at the Mosaic Covenant and you see the strong if-then conditional statements, you make a point of noting that the divines almost unanimously, I would say, agree that the law is given in the context of redemption for Israel, and that when viewed in light of our justification, the law, I think that the phrase you use out of, I forget who it is, but that the law is an enemy in the sense that there is a law-gospel distinction for justification. But in sanctification, that the two, the law sweetly complies with the gospel. Can you develop that a little bit for our listeners? Because that, it seems to me, is the biggest issue at stake in this whole discussion is, you know, what role does the law play in our justification? What role does it play in our sanctification, and how the Puritans viewed that difference?
The Puritans were very careful to always be bringing these back to pastoral issues. So it was never just, you know, these were never abstract concepts and just theologizing for the sake of it, but rather showing that there is a definite heightened legal side of the Old Covenant, and none of them deny that at all. And what they will show, of course, is that these function in such a way to bring the Israelites to seek the mercy of God in the person of Jesus Christ. So you'll see that heightened legal function, and they will not be able to trust in themselves and their own good works and those types of things. But nonetheless, for those Israelites walking by faith, trusting in God, the law was given to show them how to walk before God in holiness and righteousness. And those are the words of John Ball, for example. So clearly, for Israelites living by faith and trusting in God, the law was to help them, to guide them. It wasn't, as some have recently put, you know, just meant to be this great enemy and that's it. There was a twofold application of the law. There's, of course, the threefold, but just in terms of our salvation, one brings us to Jesus Christ and the other one brings us to Jesus Christ, but in a different way, in terms of our holiness and righteousness. So, but the talk about the republication of the covenant of works always has to just be tempered by, well, what do you mean by the covenant of works? And that's a question I often ask people when they bring up the issue. Sometimes they'll strip a quote from Owen here or somebody else there. Even Goodwin calls, he takes a sort of Salmerian position that it's a foedus subserviens, which is a subservient covenant, the Old Covenant. And so there's lots of statements that people can look at and say, well, see, what do you think of that? And I always have to ask them, well, what do you mean by the covenant of works before we talk about how it's republished at Sinai? And so that's, to me, an extremely important question.
Right. Now, when you mention Owen, you mentioned that Owen himself saw the Mosaic Covenant as not merely an administration of the covenant of grace. And in that sense, I think he would fall under the category of a republicationist in, you know, I don't know if a strict or formal sense. You mentioned several categories. But when you read Owen on Hebrews, and he'll talk about the promise of the new covenant, the law written on our heart, he'll very unequivocally, he will say that that is a reference to the moral law, the Ten Commandments that God will inscribe on the hearts of his people by his Spirit through the gospel. And so it seems to me that while a lot of new covenant theologians today will kind of latch on to Owen because of his statements about the Mosaic Covenant, I think in redemptive history and the Historia Salutis being different in some way to the covenant of grace. On the other hand, Owen will turn around and he'll say in the application of redemption, God writes the moral law on the heart of the believer. So perhaps that's helpful, just like you just said, not to pull one statement out of context or to quote Owen in one place and not to look at him on the whole. Why is Owen such an important figure? You spend a good bit of time at the end of your chapter on John Owen.
He's an important figure because he, quite simply, says things more clearly and better than everyone else in among his peers. You know, I'm constantly amazed at Owen being able to raise the types of issues that need to be raised and answer the questions that need to be answered. And he really leaves no stone unturned. And he's very sensitive to different issues. So, you know, people will call Owen a trichotomist because they'll say, well, he distinguishes between the old and new covenants as different covenants altogether, and he holds to a covenant of works. But it's just not that simple, because you have to consider how he speaks of the new covenants in relation to the covenant of grace, and he doesn't make them, as I said a little bit earlier, synonymous, because he'll talk about the way in which the death of a testator, in the case of Jesus Christ, confirms and establishes a covenant, and the covenant of grace was by promise, whereas the new covenant has that ratification in the person of Jesus Christ. So he'll talk about those types of issues which are helpful for us. And so, yeah, Owen's just a guy who's immensely clear.
Right. And as you mentioned, and you mentioned this in your work, that Owen is a dichotomist when speaking about all men being guilty and fallen federally in Adam, but that the elect are saved according to the fulfillment of the promise of the covenant of grace in Christ. And so that's even prior to Christ's coming. There's redemption only in Jesus. And anybody that holds that view, anyone that holds the view that redemption is only in Christ after the fall for all those who have fallen in Adam, is by default a dichotomist. Is that correct?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And what's interesting, and I wish I had Owen to press him on an issue, because you raised it with regard to the new covenant being the moral law written on the heart. And this may seem a little bit overly provocative, but I'm going to suggest it anyway, is that we talk about the covenant of works being revived or reduplicated or superadded, however you want to put it, at the Old Covenant. But what might be interesting to note is that you have a sort of republication of the covenant of works in the New Covenant, in the sense that the moral law is rewritten on the hearts of New Covenant saints. And so there's actually a lot of Eden in the New Covenant. Now, the distinctions you make of it's not our righteousness that gains us entrance, of course, need to be made. But there's a sense in which you can talk about a republication in the New Covenant if you're careful. Now, maybe people aren't careful enough to ever do that, and so it'd be a bad idea. But I thought that would be worth mentioning from Owen's perspective, the way he speaks about the New Covenant and the moral law written on people's hearts.
Yeah, and I think this is where Larger Catechism 97 is so helpful in which the divines say that the moral law for the regenerate is not a covenant of works for them. They're delivered from it as from the covenant of works, so that they're neither justified nor condemned, but that it has special use for them in the new covenant. And so there's an abiding significance to God's law for believers. And I do think that's one thing that you find across the board, Mark, as you've shown too, is that there is uniformity even among these diverse views on the precise relationship between everything in a covenantal system. There's uniformity on the abiding validity and usefulness of the moral law for believers in God's work of sanctification. And so I'm thankful for the work that you've done there. We have to wrap this up, so I wanted to ask you, as we head out, what, besides your chapter in this book and your chapters coming out in the book you have with Joel Beakey, what Puritan works would you recommend to our listeners that they would have access to if they wanted to dig in more to this? I know John Ball's work has been republished by Peter Reynolds in Scotland. Are there other works that they can get hold of that you would recommend if they wanted to dig deeper into the historical aspects of this discussion?
Well, it depends on how ambitious one is. I think one of the good things about reading Owen's commentary on Hebrews is that you're dealing with very rigorous exegesis of the text, and you're also dealing with theology. So he'll talk about exegesis, move into theology, and you sort of get a big picture of things from Owen, and you can generally get those Hebrews commentaries almost anywhere. So for those who really want to spend some time with Owen, I would suggest reading Owen. But you can also find reading John Ball, as you said, that there's Francis Roberts. If you can find it on Google Books, I believe it's out there. He wrote the single largest work on covenant theology among the Puritans, and I think it's 1,700 folio pages, so that's also pretty impressive. But what you'll find is that sometimes you just need to actually just do a lot of reading among the Puritans, and occasionally you'll see a section crop up out of nowhere where they discuss a certain issue, and the more reading I did, the more I was able to find some real nuggets from guys like Burgess in The Vindication of the Moral Law, or Goodwin, where he, in Volume 7, talks about the creatures. If you want a discussion of the covenant of works unlike you've read anywhere, read Goodwin of the Creatures. It's incredible the way he talks about how God had creation dues towards man, and what was owed by God towards man, his state of nature and the reward. So you've got to do a little bit of fishing yourself, and you'll be surprised at the places where you find the nuggets.
And then finally, hasn't RHB, Reformation Heritage Books, just republished some monographs of some works? Did they republish Calamy's little piece on the two covenants? Do you know?
I don't know. That's a good question.
I know they were planning to from the Westminster Assembly Project, and I think that might be out, but I'm not sure. And so if it is, our listeners might want to get a hold of that, because you referenced that in both of your chapters on the Old Covenant and the Covenant of Works. So, Camden. That's
fantastic. No, this has been a fantastic discussion. I've enjoyed just sitting back and listening to you two discuss, but I think we hit up the major features of the book. I would encourage people to pick this up in one way or another, at least go to Google Books and read portions of it. But if you can buy it, go ahead and pick it up for your library or get it through interlibrary loan. Drawn into Controversy, Reformed Theological Diversity and Debates Within 17th Century British Puritanism, co-edited by Michael Haken and our wonderful guest today, Mark Jones. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Mark. This has been fantastic. We always love having you on.
Thank you very much, guys. It was a pleasure.
Of course, you can visit Mark and find out more about his church, Faith Presbyterian Church up in Vancouver. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. I forgot to mention at the beginning of the show, he's also a research associate in the Faculty of Theology at the University of the Free State, Bloemfontein, if I'm getting that right, South Africa. And his wonderful dissertation titled Why Heaven Kissed Earth, The Christology of the Puritan Reformed Orthodox Theologian Thomas Goodwin. So you might want to look that up as well if you're interested. Stay tuned for the wonderful book with Joel Beakey, A Puritan Theology, coming out from Reformation Heritage Books. Of course, Nick is available at newcovepres.com. You can also find him at feedingonchrist.com and read more from him. Keep your eyes open for Table Talk Magazine. He's got a column in there as well. And you can find us online at reformedforum.org. There you'll find information about all of our programs, how to subscribe to them, as well as how to support us at our donate page. And if you need to get a hold of us, please email us at mail@reformedforum.org or just tweet us at Reformed Forum. We thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.